So we're going to start with a talk. Then you're going to practice teaching a group with a new partner. After that, there'll be some time for a Q&A and another talk. That talk will be by Stephanie, and then we'll be closing out the afternoon with another IRES session that I'll be guiding. So we're heading into the Anandamaya, this kosha of joy and bliss. In your manual, it's chapter 8. And before I dive into that, I wanted to just let you know that for each kosha, there is an element associated with them. So the anamaya, the kosha of the body, element of earth, that density, the pranamaya, kosha of breath and energy, is water. The manamaya, which is the kosha of emotions, feelings and emotions, is fire. And then the vijnanamaya, which is the kosha of cognitions, is air. And now where we're heading is to the anandamaya, which is space. So I'd like to start with a mini eye rest. So find your comfortable position for just 2 or 3 minutes. And I always like to look around, just notice if there's anything I can do to feel more secure, more comfortable. I've got my emotional support cat over in the corner there. You know, it's like we have what we need. Eyes can be open or closed, or you could do some of both. It's a great way to practice. And imagining that you have all the time in the world and the tasks for the moment are complete. There's nothing else on your list for the day. And you're just resting back in a comfortable position. And tuning in to any sort of sense of well-being. This felt sense of presence. Well-being of inner resource. And then as we begin to settle in, we start to feel into the body and not trying to make anything happen, but just aware of sensations, taking the time to feel. And if we had all day, we could feel and feel and feel, the body might begin to soften, the edges might become more diffuse. And we might begin to just notice the breath moving or different ways energy's flowing. And we've landed in the next kosha, breath and energy. Quite naturally. As we rest here for as long as we needed to, it could be 1 minute, could be 2 hours. Eventually, the breath and the energy relax the thoracic diaphragm, the big muscle of respiration, and emotions just naturally arise. And now, we're in the manamaya kosha, feelings and emotions. And not necessarily doing anything other than taking note of an emotion, tuning in to the felt sense of the emotion, the feeling. And isn't it true when we tune into the emotions quite naturally, the thoughts about these emotions start to arise, and beliefs, images. And now we've landed in the vijnanamaya kosha, cognitions. And if we had all day and took all the time and we met each emotion, we met each belief, so all these parts felt seen and heard, attention becomes liberated from these emotions and thoughts. And quite naturally, perhaps a feeling of equanimity arises. Love, joy, just the ease. And here we have landed in the Anandamaya Kosha, the layer of bliss and joy. So when you're ready, go ahead and open the eyes. And opening the eyes from this place . So I love teaching this kosha, because when I first started, I was listening to cassettes of Richard Miller. And he kept talking about, and now call forward a feeling of joy. And I'd be like, what's that? It wasn't accessible. And for a while, I thought that something was wrong with me because I couldn't access it. And it wasn't until I actually took the very first level one training that he taught, where he explained how this is very normal. And in fact, when we're connecting with these feelings, I think of them like amplified well-being, like love, joy, gratitude. The opposite can very naturally come right up. So we have the sankalpa, the aspect of well-being or joy. That's bringing us home, right? It's bringing us maybe a felt sense into the body or the heart, or it's also bringing us home to being this presence or open, spacious awareness. But there is that vikalpa part of this, that which is taking us away, taking us out of harmony. And super important to know that. And one of the things that I found too, like the degree of joy that was felt, then a similar vibration of an opposite might come up, or vice versa. Can go both ways. So there's two kinds of joy here. There's joy that's dependent, joy that is depending on things going our way, on people behaving how we think they should, and joy that's dependent on the world being a certain way. And then there's a joy that's independent of our circumstances. This can arise in the midst of the intensity of life. So we can start over time and with practice to have joy and love and gratitude for no reason at all. And that can get kind of confusing too. I had an experience many years ago now with my boyfriend at the time, he's my husband now, where he has cancer. He has two different autoimmune diseases that are very, very serious. And he ended up in the hospital, and he was in the ICU for a month and a half and in the hospital for 4 months. And back then, they let me stay. They gave me a cot and I lived in his room, and I would go to work, teach a yoga class, come back, you know, be the studio manager, do what work I could from the hospital room. And there was a point where he was still in the ICU where we didn't know if he was going to live. And it was very dire circumstances, and I couldn't sleep. And this was before they had a whole lot of security at the hospital, because I would wander the halls at night and I would just walk and walk and walk because I was so distressed. And I remember one night just at the height of this distress and really not knowing what was going to happen, but thinking I was pretty sure what was going to happen. And then this huge bubble of joy came forward. And at first I was taken aback. It was almost like, how could I feel so happy in the midst of something so dire? But that you know, once we start connecting with these feelings of well-being, they kind of can show up for no reason at all. And as we're learning how the opposites quite naturally co-arise, and he survived, and you know, here we are like 16 years later. So, but it was a really real eye-opener for me to feel so joyful in the midst of something so uncomfortable. So once we land here, it's a lovely kosha, and you know, a beautiful place to, I think of it like soaking in it, nourishing ourselves with this well-being. But as Stephanie mentioned earlier, it is a kosha. It's a layer kind of resting on this open, spacious awareness. So because it's a kosha, what we start to learn is there's more beyond that. And I don't know, have any of you heard of Anandamayi Ma? She was a saint in India, a guru. Oh, there's beautiful pictures of her. And the Anandamayi Ma was her name. And it was like the bliss permeated mother. And she spent years in bliss. And you can Google Anandamayi Ma and see these beautiful pictures of this woman just, transported, infused, exuding bliss. And as the story goes, one day it went away. And her disciples were very worried, very worried. And as the story goes, they would come to her and say, Ma, what's happened? We've noticed you've lost your bliss. And she is reported to have said, I know, isn't it wonderful? I'm no longer distracted from this next aspect, which we'll be going into as we go through the training, the sense of awareness. Beautiful, just beautiful. And how lovely, I think, to know it's like it doesn't end here. There's more. So within this kosha, what might arise, like compassion, so we talked about friendliness, joy, equanimity, the four Brahmavihara, the four great attitudes or immeasurables. And we can also, I think it's important to experiment weaving in our inner resource here. Yeah, and we can experiment with it like as a continuum of joy. And if Kajal, if you would show that slide for a moment. Yeah. So thinking of this as like the continuum of joy. Joy might start with just like this first, the barest hint of a blush, of warmth, calmness, content. And there could be many other words here. And it might grow a little bit more to a feeling of delight, happiness, pleasure. I would put equanimity on there, joy. And it's like, when I feel these, it's like feeling a higher and higher vibration, right? Bliss could open out into ecstasy. And then also it can go too far. It can be a sense of going into mania. So there's joy that's constructive and helpful to us. And you could think of mania, if we go too far, that's joy that's not constructive, right? Yeah. So I like to think of this as music. And it's like playing the scales of an instrument. And we can touch in with all of these different aspects of joy and grow our capacity to be with these sort of, for lack of a better word or metaphor, like a higher frequency of well-being. Thanks, Kajal. And I also encourage you, when you hear me saying the word joy, and if that's not the experience you're having, use your word. Maybe it's just a subtle feeling of presence. Maybe your word is love or maybe it's gratitude, or, you know, use your word. It's going to work the best for you. But what we know is joy is really good medicine. It's like vitamin J, as one of my friends, another IRS trainer, Fuko, who's been here a couple times over the last few days, she used to call it vitamin J. And, you know, it's like laughter. Laughter itself is good medicine. And there's all kinds of like laughter clubs and things you can do. And even if you don't feel like laughing and you do, it boosts mood. It boosts our immune system. It helps alleviate pain. It's incredibly healing. And can also, like, doing laughter, I often, in, when I would teach in the studio, we would do laughing in class together. And often people would report, you know, it actually, I started to cry. Something came up and it's like, yep, there's the opposite of the kalpa coming right up. So joy can evoke sort of an overall sense of well-being. And sometimes just when we tune into a very subtle well-being, it can open us up into joy. And one of the things that I found really interesting when I was first learning this is that kind of lower, like the neuroscience of joy, which is, this is in your manual, by the way. Like when we're under chronic stress or duress, the amygdala enlarges. These are these two sort of almond-shaped structures within the brain, have to do with like memory, decision-making, like emotions. They grow. And we can literally be hijacked by our emotions. We might not have control over them at all if the amygdala have grown. And another structure called the hypothalamus, it thins out, it shrinks a little bit. And the hypothalamus is kind of like what can give us a sense of time and sense of context. So in these circumstances, we might not be able to think clearly about what the consequences of our actions might be. And so it's really, especially if we're under a lot of stress or duress, chronic post-traumatic stress, I mean, it is changing the structures in our brain. Another thing that they found through research is like people are having, tend to be unhappier, more depressed, anxious. Babies who cry a lot have more like electrical activity in the right half of the frontal lobe. People who are happier, calmer, babies who don't cry very much have more on the left. And so what they've found, like research is showing that these practices that we're doing, like little and often tuning into a feeling of well-being, is actually starting to give us a left lateral shift. So it's not like that we're going to go over there and stay. The way I think of it, and I know, you know, neuroscience is constantly changing. This is such a, it's still, you know, a lot to learn here. But it's the way I get a sense of it is we're growing neural pathways. We're getting more access to that left lateral shift, more access to feeling of well-being. So many people show like that those ratios change with regular little and often practice. The research also shows that like it's really, really good news is how changeable and adaptable the brain is. Yeah. Because with practice, our brains change. And I can tell you, you know, just from the very first IRS training that I took, when I learned about the plasticity of the brain and how with these practices we can change the brain, I burst into tears because I really thought I was stuck where I was, anxiety, depression, you know, but there was real hope. And I feel like it's something that has been realized, and I feel like I'm living and feeling those changes. research shows that regular, I think of it like as doses of mild to moderate negative, so-called negative emotions, actually make us more resilient to like higher, or what's the word I'm thinking of, like higher orders of more challenging emotions. So think of that when we're doing the opposites, or if you're guiding someone in an IRS practice, you're doing opposites in the group practice, and they're like, "Why are you asking me to feel bad?" You know, it's like, yeah, you know, regular doses, mild to moderate, uncomfortable emotions are making us more resilient. You can think of this as kind of like an inoculation. And we also know that regular doses of positive emotions increase the likelihood of us having more. So we're just noticing the good. And another thing I like to touch on here is something that it's called the day's review. It's like we could feel back, like at the end of the day, we can feel back through our day and notice if there's anything that left like a sticky residue, like, oh, I wish I hadn't said that. Oh, I knew if I ate that, I wouldn't feel good, but I did it anyway. Yeah, I'm just talking about myself here. And so one of the things that we can do, if we feel back really kindly through our day, we notice something that stuck and landed and left that sticky residue, we can actually go in and redo it the way we wanted it to go. Now we redo it multiple times. Like, oh, I wish I hadn't said XYZ to my husband. And so in my mind, I go through and I replay the event how I wished it had gone. Not because I'm like, you know, rose-colored glasses, la, 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 but because what I'm doing is I'm growing stronger neural pathways. And the chances are maybe the next time, and I'm sure there will be another situation that I might have more access to how I would like to be. Yeah. And always knowing, you know, we're doing the best we know how each moment, and then we can grow our ability to have responses that feel better. So I'd like to change gears. You might write down any questions if you have them. We will have that question and answer period later. Because where we're heading next after this talk is you'll be with your partner teaching a group IRS practice. So we're just going to do one of these today. So tomorrow you'll be with the same person, and then whoever was facilitating today is going to receive tomorrow. So just remember that we're just doing one. But to get you ready for this, can you have handy in your resource guide the script number 2? This is page 21 through 26. And then I'd also like you to have the debrief questions, which is on page 71. So I'll say that again. Group script number 2, page 21 through 26. It's in the chat box also. And the debrief, page 71. So this debrief can be really helpful to get the ball rolling when you're debriefing with your partner. This session, instead of an hour like you had last time, is going to be 45 minutes. So you will need to pay attention to your timing if you're the facilitator to make sure that you do leave some time at the end for debrief. And you know, this is, you know, a training. it's challenging to end something on time. So, you know, do the best you can. Sometimes it might mean instead of like going into a whole section, maybe you just ask them to note any thoughts, right? There's ways you can condense things. You can still meet it, but you're condensing it a little bit, right? I think that debrief is very important because this is your opportunity to get the feedback or feed forward from your partner. Also, when you're delivering this I-REST, I'd like you to imagine that this is a group of 30. as you're reading the script to your partner, they are a group of 30. So you know in a group of 30, there's going to be some people that are snoring. There's going to be other people who are wiggling around. You know, it's going to be what it is. So I'd like to walk through a little bit of how a typical group I-REST practice goes, like a class. And you watch Stephanie do this, how she sort of oriented you to what was going to happen. She interviewed you, did the practice, and then there was some time for debrief to help people wake up. So we have the initial, like checking in, how you doing, taking the time to orient them to the practice, especially if we're deciding to change something. We can interview them, like get their words for inner resource. So if you like, you could sprinkle those words. And you could try this with your partner today. Yeah. Then you go into the practice and you're following the script, the 10 steps, and know that, you know, we can expand some, we can condense others, but we're still touching on each one. We're interweaving the inner resource throughout the protocol. We're kind of moving from things being objects to being a witness and dissolving into the witness, witnessing presence, feeling presence of being, you know, and then from being, we can open into awareness. So you might notice, I'd love you to see if you notice it in the script where we're interweaving that abiding as being or awareness throughout the protocol. And then there's the transitions of closing. How do you end? How do you ease people out of I-REST, but then still make sure that they're going to be safe? Like if they're needing to drive somewhere, even cross a street. I had someone in class, even though I felt like I had done a really good job trying to like wake everyone up, she walked out and almost got hit by a bicycle. You know, just as simple as that. It's like we really need to like recoagulate and ground before we head out. And it's really helpful to, if you've delivered a practice, to debrief yourself. And in your manual, in chapter 12 on page 71, I just want to point this out. If you don't have your manual handy, don't feel like you have to run and grab it, but you might write this down. It's an extensive list, so you can check in with yourself. And in fact, this list also was, for me, the kind of training wheels that helped me to slowly, after I had worked with the script for a good long time, to sort of transform, to let relax that a little bit. So the interviewing, you know, we go into that more in level two, but I hope you're getting a sense of how we've been interviewing a little bit at the beginning of the practices for their words. So we're kind of like helping students customize the language to make it their own, because I remember one time one of my friends was in class and her name was Joy, and I kept saying, "Feel Joy," and she's just like, "What?" You know, so she's like, she had to every time I said that, she had to like put in a different word. Just wasn't working for her. So the words will work or not work. So it's really good to help find words and make allowances, like let them know to make it their own word. We can also, when we're teaching, we can work with themes. Like as Stephanie mentioned, there's like, once you finish this training, you'll have accessible to you like different outlines for series classes, scripts for an 8-week series, and we can work with themes. And so we can often like inquire, like if we're sitting down in a class, we can talk to the students, like what are their needs today? And, or we can like talk to them and get like what kind of themes, what's happening in life right now? What would be helpful today? So it can really help us discern our focus for the group. It's not that I'm going to like change the script, but I might go, oh, you know, folks are sharing with me, they're really stressed out right now. And so let's do a really, really long inner resource of leisurely body sensing, some breath, and then I'll just note emotions and cognitions and continue on through the practice. So you can kind of highlight low light. The length of a typical class is 60 to 90 minutes. And as you've been watching us, like today, I think Stephanie had 60 minutes. Today I'll have 45 minutes. So I'm going to make it as much like a class, so you can, again, get a sense of how we might do that. 35 to 40 minutes is a good amount of time for the actual iRest practice, right? If we go too longer, people tend to drop into theta or delta, or, you know, like deep sleep, and then it's really, really hard for them to come up out of it. So keeping it 35, 40 minutes can be good. Really important, as best you can, to begin on time and to end on time, to really be respectful of people's time, knowing that they might have places they need to be. So as when we're moving into the practice with them, we're just going into like opening the senses, opening to this felt sense of the vital life force. We're supporting like spaciousness, but not necessarily spaciness. Sometimes they're hard to discern. In our languaging, we're moving from your, like feel your hand, to the, feel the hand. So we're moving from the personal to the impersonal. And then less is more. One year, I decided to really check this out with my students, and I told them, I said, okay, we're going to be doing some work with opposites, and I'm going to experiment with how long I give you in each side of the opposite in the iRest practice. And I was like, okay, you know, first it was just like, you know, a few breaths, and they're like, not long enough, you know, and then it was, you know, 10 seconds, 15, 20, 30. And they're like 30. We want 30, you know? So it's like, it can be helpful to check in with your group. And also I like to record myself, then I can listen and I can feel. It's like, oh, I really sped through that. I couldn't feel it. I didn't have the time to feel it. So less is more. And they say like, I don't know, 50, 55 words per minute. Important to understand why you're deviating from the protocol if you do. You know, the protocol stays similar. And often when we're teaching, especially to in groups that might have had a lot of trauma, we keep it the same. And it's having the same every time, that helps make it feel safe. And then people actually can go deeper and deeper and deeper. If even when you're keeping it the same each time, as the teacher, you might be like, you know, or it might be, oh, I want to change this because it's more interesting to me. So it's really important to check that out when you start to try to change how you're teaching the class. We want to use all the five senses. So if you're having them like imagine like an inner resource, or use memory or imagination to connect with a feeling of joy, really help give them time. Call out, how would this be? What would it smell like, taste like? You know, use all those senses. And really important that we're not imposing imagery on people, but asking them, letting theirs just spontaneously arise. I think also really important that it's okay to move, right? But check out why you're moving. Maybe you need to, maybe you don't. It's okay to open your eyes, right? Maybe you need to, maybe you don't, but check it out. It's, I've had someone who in class, she had my permission. She did it super quietly, but she would just do the whole class. She would just do kind of freeform slow movement, which is now where we're getting into the body sensing or the tandava, the moving meditation. But that was like, it helped her feel safe and it wasn't distracting to the rest of the group. So there's no wrong way to do it. And the way I think about this is like, we don't want this to be state specific, right? We want this to be available to us in life. So if we meditate in the same position all the time, that might be where we've gotten that sense of our sense of peace or ease or equanimity. But can we do it laying on our back, our front, left side, right side, sitting, standing, moving? Yeah. So we're in a way, we're like really integrating the practice into all. It's going to come. I find a better sense of it coming with me out in the world where I really need it. When we're ending a class, we're moving back into the world again, that sense of really taking the time to ground. You might have like your own kind of closing ritual, but check in with them. You know, they might have their own, and you could open time to let them do movement or things like that for their own closing ritual. And then having time for reflections to help transition into the waking state. And often I found so many times I open it up at the end for reflections and there's nothing. And so I sit there in silence and I wait a little bit. And then something might come forward. And then if not, I always have like a question or two in my back pocket. Like, how was that for you? Were you present when we were doing this part of the practice? How was that? You know, and then just getting people thinking is going to help wake them back up. Techniques for intervening when people fall asleep. What do we do? First of all, they might need to sleep. There's nothing wrong with that. And I remember I'm blanking on her name right now, but another IRS trainer, she told me this story of like, she said this in class, like said something about, you know, if you wanted to stay awake, you can try this or that or the other. You could, if you're laying on your back, you might like bend your arms. If you fall asleep, your arm falls, it wakes you up. And she had an irate student at the end of the class. And he says, look, this is the only place where I feel safe enough to sleep. And you're taking this away from me. So, you know, it's okay. It's okay. But, you know, it's also okay to want to be present during the practice. So one thing, like I mentioned, if you're laying on your back, if I'm on my back right now, my arm would be like this. And it would fall. Although I have a friend who says she can sleep like that, no problem. she's got a lot of kids. you can practice with eyes open versus eyes closed, or do some of both. If you're feeling yourself starting to to really drop into the deeper stages of sleep, open your eyes. As a teacher, we can modulate our voice. Like, notice how it feels when I talk with a monotone. What does this do? You know, it's like people like, whoa, out we go. So you might modulate your voice a little bit. Sometimes just asking a question, phrasing something in the form of a question while you're teaching, reading the script. It could be, what does this feel like in your body? And people are like, did she just ask me a question? You know, it's sort of like can brighten the room up a little bit. Using sounds during the practice, like Stephanie had us humming the other night, can help wake us up a little bit, brighten things up. Walking around the room, like you can feel like a dull spot in the room, you might walk over there, project your voice a little bit. And in this way, just sort of move about the space. Again, really important to let people know that you are, if you are going to be moving around the room. What else do I want to say? Yeah. Feeling empty. We have.
Could I offer just a question into the room that might
be
perfect for here?
Please.
Okay. What if someone in your group is snoring really loudly or possibly distracting others with the snoring?
Yeah. I've had this happen multiple times, and it was someone also who had really severe sleep apnea, so he would stop breathing and then people would get scared. And so one of the things that I did was I talked to him about it as kindly as I could and just saying, I'm noticing this is happening during practice. I'm feeling concerned about the other students. And what we worked out with, I was at a yoga studio. I had a lot of props, but I propped him up. So he was quite elevated, wasn't laying down anymore. And, but he still had the sense that he could lean back a little bit, and that really mitigated the snoring. But other times, I mean, often they're snoring. And one of the things I like to do is just call it out. Notice the sounds going on around you. Just, it's part of the practice, right? It's how do we, here's the truth. This is happening. Can I meet this? Can I meet my preferences to have a quiet practice, right? So I think that can be a really important part of the practice too. What I found often is, you know, we're not, even if we're deep sleep snoring, there's still a part of us that's awake and present, right? This awareness. So when I had the ability to walk around the room, I would walk and I would teach next to the person. And just having, they would feel me there. And often, very often, it would stop snoring. Noise can happen. I'm teaching at the yoga studio. I've had a jackhammer outside the room, and we wove it into the practice. And at the end, I asked, how did that go with the jackhammer? And they're like, what jackhammer? Yeah, you know, there is, like, if someone falls asleep, I might touch your leg. I don't feel comfortable doing that. Even if it's someone I know and I have an agreement with, and maybe we've talked about it ahead, but I'm if it's someone I don't know, I don't want to take the chance of really startling someone. Or some people come up swinging out of sleep. But you have to, you know, it might be a group that you're very comfortable with. You've talked about it beforehand. And it's really okay. But that's me. Yeah. And we're at the end of our time. So if you have questions, write them down. And then again, we'll have that question and answer period in a little bit later. Thank you.